coming to this talk. What I would like to do in the next hour or so is to share with you some of my findings and reflection over what I've done in the last almost 4 years. And the title of my thesis is Aspects of the Divine from the Perspective of the Witness. So straight from the beginning, what I'm aiming at is to try to reassess to some extent the theistic ideas, views, concepts that we find in Shankara's writings. And in order to do that, I found that it was very helpful to look at the concept of the sakshi, the concept of the witness that it is known. Because I think it gives us a much deeper perspective on theism in general in Shankara Vedanta. I think it's also very helpful because it really helps us to extract, I think, Shankara Vedanta from the nest of mysticism as it is defined today. Today what people understand about Shankara Vedanta is that he is basically an amalgam of Samkhya and Yoga Darshana. Should explain a little bit what I mean by that. People think that to understand the truth of Advaita Vedanta, that there is only one reality without a second, one should read the Upanishads and the related literature, but that in that way one can only get an understanding, an intellectual comprehension of the truth of Advaita. So in order to really get this truth, to imbibe this truth, literally, one has to revert to the teaching of yoga, as we find Patanjali Yoga Sutras. I think this is erroneous. And I think this talk will help us perhaps distinguish what Shankara Vedanta is from the Samkhya Yoga Darshana. My thesis look at three aspects basically of the divine. The first aspect is that of the creator. Brahman conceived as the creator. The second aspect is Brahman, which is conceived in terms of a benevolent entity who bestows his grace on certain devotees. That has been work has been done by Malkovsky predominantly. He is a scholar who thinks that ultimately it's the grace of the Lord that brings about liberation. And I should begin by the first one, which is that the first aspect of a creator. Now, to understand how in Shankara Vedanta Brahman can be a creator, we have to look at various teachings that we find here in number one of the sheet. We find the witnessing standpoint, the prayer, physical, and the sensitive doctrines in Shankara soteriology. The first method, I think, the most comprehensive method found in Shankara Vedanta is that known as the Avastataya Viveka, or the discrimination of the three states. It is a method for including the true nature of consciousness in the Nivritti Dharma. So the first distinction I need to make is the distinction between what Shankara conceives as the Pravritti Dharma and the Nivritti Dharma. I'm going to talk mainly here about the Nivritti Dharma, which is a conception of the Vedic Dharma, which Shankara speaks about in various places. And Pravritti Dharma means basically engagement. It's a category, in a certain sense, where the students who have no discrimination, who cannot cease to identify with the body, mind, and senses, are found. And particular means are resorted to for these specific students. The other category, these students are no discrimination whatsoever. It's important to emphasize that. The other category is the category of Nivritti Dharma. And in that Nivritti Dharma, the students are those who have some discrimination. And by discrimination, I think, you can please feel free to stop me at any point, I think that he refers to the students who have had some form of intuition of the self, of the witness. they can distinguish the not-self from the self. Now, there are various methods by which, in the Nirviti Dharma, the teacher can draw the student to take this standpoint, this intuition about the self. I'm going to speak here about the most comprehensive one, I think, which is that, again, of the Avasatayi Viveka, the discrimination between the three states. Now, you see in the first section on the left, we have what is known as the waking state. The Mandukya 3 speaks of the self, which is one without a second, as having basically four patterns. The first one is the self with the adjunct of the waking state and waking individual called Vaishvanara. The depiction of that state is comprised, in fact, the psychological aspect and bodily aspect of the individual, the antakarana, as well as the organ of sense, the five breaths and organs of action. All of these together are called the 19 mouths. They call mouths for Shankara because they are means by which the individual apprehends the world, its surroundings. Not only apprehends, but interacts with them. And the Saptanga, the seven limbs, are basically the universe outside of oneself. So, in that state of the waking, we have basically an individual and the object that the individual apprehends and interacts in and with in that waking state. In the second column, we have Tejasa. Again, the Mandukya speaks of it as the one same self, Brahman, but this time with the adjunct of the dream state and the dream individual. And here, the Mandukya is clear that it's exactly the same depiction that this state has. It has all the features of the individual and the world apprehended in the waking state. You find the Ekonabim Shatimukha, the 19 mouths, and you find the Saptanga, the seven limbs. The individual with all its equipment, psychophysical equipment, and the entire universe that is apprehended by that individual. So the feature is exactly the same. And Gaudapada, in his Charita on the Mandukya, says that in fact they are dreamlike. These two are in fact one state. He says that they are nothing but dream. It's a dream. He looks at them as one state. Now, let me read you a few quotes concerning this particular aspect. That by which one perceives both the state of sleep and of being awake, knowing that it's the immense all-pervading self, a wise man does not grieve. This is from Kappa 4.4. And Shankara's gloss reads, dream is to be known, the state of dream and the dream content. And similarly, waking is to be known, the state of waking and the waking content. That self by which he perceives both states of waking and dream, and the rest here is to be understood as before, knowing that is the immense self, all-pervading self, a wise man does not grieve. Here what we are asked to do is to take a perspective by which one is to see the principle through which the waking state and its waking content, the dream state and its dreaming content are perceived. And for Shankara and Gaudapada, it can't be the waking individual because the waking individual is comprised in its waking state. There is no possibility for Shankara for the waking features to penetrate the dream and vice versa. Nothing of the dream ever goes into the waking. So, by inference in a certain sense, one has to understand that there is a principle different from the waking ego and different from the dream ego that perceives these two states and their content, the coming and their going. That is the discrimination that one has to do in order to see, to recognize, or to take a stand in that very principle, which is called the witnessing self, the sakshi. Even for a moment, if you can take that stand, then you are a viveki, you become someone who discriminates between the not-self and the self. Now, this is a method, of course, which engages one to look at the self, taking these two states. Now, one can do that also just with the waking. And we have, for example, the teaching of the Taittiriya Upanishad, where one is to discriminate from, just like you gave the example of the onion in your talk, it's like peeling off the layers of the not-self. One can do that even in his or her waking state. We take the individuals here to be all this conglomeration of sense organ, of organs of action, of mind, of thought, of eye notion, and all the things we call I, and I take this as the apprehender who apprehends the world. But Shaka says, even the waking, for one who has some form of introvertedness, one can see that what one calls the body is in fact just like this table, which is an object to one's awareness. In his Adhyasa Bhaja, he says that it's impossible, in fact, to ever mix them up, because the subject can, by nature, never become the object, and the object can never become the subject. It's an impossibility. So he says, by discrimination, the viveka, one can see that one is not that. So one can discriminate one is not the body, one can discriminate that one is not the senses by which the world is apprehended. One can discriminate that one is not the thought. And finally, one can discriminate that one is not the I notion. I am happy, I am unhappy, I am a witness even. One is to actually see that one is the witness itself, witnessing this very I notion, which is always changing. So, discrimination can happen in the waking alone, or by means of, again, taking one's stance away from these two states. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad speaks about this well, which always goes from one bank to the other. The bank are the two banks of waking and dreaming. And that well, which is the self, the witness, never actually reaches those banks. And is not affected. He goes freely between the two, but ever detached. This is the detached witness that he wants the students to recognize. Now there is a third aspect of this Avastataya Viveka, Rayal Sri, the third aspect of it is Prajna. And Prajna is deep sleep. Now, the characteristic of these two states, as I've mentioned, is that there is an appearance of subject and object. In the waking world, there is a waking ego going about its business, interacting in the waking world with its space, its time, its sun, and other luminaries, etc. In a dream, we have a dream ego with whom we identify, and we carry out our business as well in the same fashion until this state gets falsified. But what characterizes deep sleep is that there is no appearance of subject. The 19 mouths are not there, and the world is not there either. So there's no subject and no object. The grasper and the grasp are both absent. And Shankara tells us that in fact there is no there's no dream or waking phenomena there, because there's no ignorance. The perception of duality is due to a misconception called adhyasa. It to take again all these instruments that we have there, to take them, to make them ours. And similarly, to take the self and attribute the characteristic of the self onto those instruments. This is the fundamental adhyasa that Shankara speaks about. But in the case of prajna, this adhyasa is not there, and there's no plurality seen at all. In fact, we can, another way perhaps to represent this, which is maybe more clear, you can see, because I like sketches a lot, to make points much better. We would have here, so this is an imaginary line, the Kalpa line, with here perhaps, but the waking state can be considered here, this is pure consciousness. And here is the adhyasa taking place. So you can just transpose all these here and all these here, and you have the waking and the dream. Vyajata happens right here between the intellect and the self, where the self basically permeates the intellect, and the individual mistake these two characteristics and superimpose them onto each other. And by this first mistake, then the whole Vyavahara, the whole empirical life begins and proceeds. But in deep sleep, there is no Abhyasa, no identification, and there's no possibility of apprehending any world, because there's nothing other than oneself. It's only pure consciousness alone. Now this is interesting from the viewpoint of Brahman as the creator, because what happens is that for Shankara, knowing this pure consciousness, but this deep sleep is also can also be viewed as the cause for the coming and the going of waking and dreams. And because we all experience deep sleep, and deep sleep is the Lord, therefore in deep sleep we are identified with pure consciousness, the Lord, and therefore we become the very substratum through which those waking and those dreaming worlds emanate.
So let me.
There is a big contention today. There's a heated debate on this very point. There is a school in Bangalore, often called the Micro School, actually wrongly so, but anyway, who contends that it is not so, that it's impossible. And I'm going to read some passages, and perhaps we'll come back to this very point. In the examination of the three states, deep sleep is described as the state that is pure consciousness alone, directly and effortlessly apprehended by everyone. In Chandogya 6.8.1, Udalaka Aruni explains the nature of sleep to his son Shvetaketu by telling him that when man sleeps, he enters his own being, the real. He says, "Son, learn from me the nature of sleep. When one says here, the man is sleeping, son, then he is united with the existent. Into himself he has entered. Therefore people say with reference to him, he is sleeping, svapiti, for then he has entered into himself." And in Brihadaranyaka 4.3.32, Shankara argues that deep sleep is a direct experience of the non-duality of the self. I quote, "When, in deep sleep, the ignorance that presented other objects has subsided, there being thus no other object differentiated by ignorance, what should one see, smell, or know, and through what? It is ignorance that creates duality, but here, in deep sleep, it has been pacified. Therefore, it is the one seer, for the inherent nature of the seer, the life of the self, cannot be lost." You see, it cannot be lost because it is always present, always manifest. It is Swayam Jyoti and Swayam Sita. It is self-lit and self-established, and there's no possibility for it to be absent. And for Shankara, it is recognizable, it can be intuitively known, because it's always present. This discrimination is that whether the state come or whether they go, I'm not affected. All things come and go in the light of my own experience. And that experience is the intuitive knowledge, the discriminative knowledge that I think Shankara is talking about. Now, though it is true consciousness, it is also named the cause of all things, the womb of the matrix of all phenomena. And there, of course, that substantiates that. Glossing Chandogya 6.8.1, Shankara reiterates the identity of deep sleep and Ishvara three times. And I quote the three passages here as one. "Identified with and established in the mind, the jiva performs the empirical tasks of thinking, seeing, hearing. And when this ceases in deep sleep, the jiva attains his own nature alone, that of the deity." Aruna told Shvetaketu about that state, the supreme deity that becomes his own self, which turns back from the sense object with the cessation of the mind. And then the last one. "I will now point out that in deep sleep alone, one's own nature is the deity, liberated from individuality, the jivatva." Further, in his commentary to verses 5 and 6 of the Mandukya Upanishad, Shankara follows the steps of Gaudapada, speaking of the causal state of deep sleep in terms that describe Ishvara's lordship, notably through the use of agentive nouns like the gnatru, the knower. Commenting the fifth verse, he states that prajna alone is the knower of all things, the knower of the past and the future. So the sixth verse goes, this one prajna indeed, in its own nature, is the lord of everything, of all the plurality that is born along with the heavens. I'll pass out two more verses. Look at the last one here. Shankara's gloss on Prashna Upanishad 4.6.7 also supports the idea that Deep Sleep and Ishvara are non-different with regard to both their nature and function. In Prashna 4.6, Shankara mentions the characteristics of Deep Sleep, which also apply to the self: unbounded consciousness, one without a second, tranquil, etc. In the following verse, while the identity of Deep Sleep and the self is reaffirmed, the causal role of Deep Sleep is introduced through an illustration. At this time, there is this bliss in the body, which is unbounded consciousness, tranquil, wholly pervading the body. At this time, in Deep Sleep, causes and effects that are connected to desire and action that pertain to ignorance become pacified. The nature of the self manifesting differently because of limiting agents is without a second, one, auspicious and tranquil. When they, causes and effects, have become pacified. In order to indicate this state, there is the following illustration. That is the illustration. Just like birds, my dear boy, go towards the tree for the sake of inhabiting, or getting rest in it. Like that, everything, all causes and effects, goes towards the Supreme Self, the imperishable. So here again, in accord with the bird tree analogy, we see that Deep Sleep and Ishvara are really very much the womb for everything. It is really that substratum from which everything comes about. It is that through which, that consciousness through which everything is pervaded, everything is sustained, and into which everything emerges back. Now, there are limits to this kind of viveka, because the methodology of teaching here is the superimposition of states, of course, on that pure consciousness. It is not so that there are really three states. For the purpose of teaching that one consciousness is at a second, three states are attributed, of course, but ultimately, because the pramana of the Upanishads, the antipramana, the last means of knowledge of the Upanishads, is neti neti atman. The only way to teach this reality is through negation. And so these three states also have to be negated somehow.
I think you
yes.
Have a little discussion here.
Yes, yes, please.
Because you've been using the word Ishvara and Prajna.
Yes.
And also saying there is a creation. Now, you will have to make a distinction between what are these two words doing there. Ishvara equal to Prajna.
Yeah.
The context. And what does creation really mean? Because if avidya is not there, ignorance is not there, there is no creation, right?
That's right.
Okay. So, avidya is present, and the causal, why is it called causal? Because it comes out of deep sleep, and in the moment of coming out of deep sleep, there is again the waking and the dream will happen. Okay.
Yeah.
That's why it's called. Okay? So now, why is it called Ishvara? The distinction between these two will have to be brought out, I think, because otherwise, you're trying to make a case.
Well, it is called, my understanding is that it is called Ishvara in relation, again, to the ignorance which we all have, which is that I am an individual of the waking, and I have dreams, and then I have deep sleep, and then I wake up again. This is the ignorance that I think Shankara wants and Gosa wants to be removed. So, of course, in relation to these appearances of space, which we take to be true, this causality is brought in by compassion, in fact, for the student who is ignorant, who thinks that, in fact, yes, he undergoes these three states in succession, but it's only a superimposition. It's the teaching taking, yes, of course, that the teacher and the Upanishad take it for granted that there's only one without a second, but because the student thinks really that he is in samsara, that he undergoes these states, the mechanism of superimposition is resorted to, and yet temporarily he will or she will give credit to this view of ignorance and say, yes, of course you're ignorant, of course, yes, you need to attain this fourth state, which is beyond the three states. But I think this is all within the realm of superimposition, and Ishvara, of course, also is within the realm of superimposition in that sense.
Who is Ishvara?
Ishvara is Prajna. Ishvara is Brahman.
Saguna.
They're all... Well, it's Saguna, as long as, of course, ignorance pertains, but the nature of ignorance is only a misconception. It's only a false idea. Not the, again, it's true that in the Pachankara Vedanta tradition, we have a development which is that ignorance is a bhava-rupa. But I think this is something
you are
that...
You sticking to...
I'm sticking to Adhyasa, and Adhyasa is nothing other than a misconception. It's Nitya Jnana, not Nitya Agyana, as later Advaitins would say, but it's Nitya Jnana. It's a false knowledge, nothing other than that.
I was only trying to point out, because you're using Mandukya Upanishad, because Mandukya has these four stages, and at four stages they are equating each one to, Vaishvanara, Prajna. Then you have the Tejasa, Prajna, and then of course Brahma. So if you put that on this chart, I think it will make the whole thing will become much clearer. Because then Ishvara becomes Saguna Brahma.
Yes. But my contention here is this, that I'm going to put a point here, but this is Prajna, yes?
Yeah,
with no manifestation.
Yeah.
Now, ignorance produces only duality. When one perceives duality, one wants an end to it. One doesn't perceive duality, one doesn't want any end to it, because there's no subject. The idea of an I who is bound in samsara is not present. Now, this pure concept, which is the fourth pada in the Mandukya Turiya, or Brahman really, the pure absolute reality, non-dual, is exactly the same as this Prajna or Ishvara. Now, it is called Ishvara because here, because of the ignorance of the student who sees the appearance of waking and dream, of course this Brahman, again, has to be superimposed with the idea that he's a creator. But really they're one without a second. This Prajna and this Brahman is the same. It becomes Ishvara for the year.
Prajna is not Brahman, Atman is Brahman. Prajna is Saguna Brahman, that is Ishvara, as you very rightly said. I think maybe your Mandukya Upanishad, you check up, they'll have these four stages.
Yes.
Brahman will be Atma, and Prajna will be Ishvara, and Tejasa will be your...
I understand very well. This is a well-known...
Can you... maybe that your sketch will make it very clear. If you put those four tables, it will become very clear, and at what stage,
Well, I mean, the fourth one, in fact, is, in fact, the whole page, right? How would you like me to, I'm not sure I understand your point.
I was only trying to say that Atman has to be Brahman, right?
Yeah.
In the And if Atman is Brahman, then, of course, if you go from here, it is waking, dreamless, and the last stage. So you have Jagrat equal to Vaishvanara, dream equal to Tejasa, Sushupti equal to Prajna, and Atman, Brahman or Atman equal to Brahman. That is the fourth stage, right?
Yes.
So that's all it means.
Yes.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
Okay.
What I'm trying to say is perhaps instead of doing this, if you can use that vertical kind of a thing, one column, all the four, Brahman, Saguna Brahman, then of course Prajna, and this one, the word, and the other one, Atman, Prajna, Tejasa, and...
Okay.
Okay?
But I thought you were disagreeing on the fact that Prajna and Ishvara are identical.
You see, because you always have two levels. I'm sorry, I don't want to monopolize this. No? Mm-hmm. That's not the intention at all. And please don't take it in the other way, okay? Because I thought, no, my idea is just to tell you, because of course one reality, and how can grace come into the picture? Because see, grace plays a role according to, and surely you can make a thesis in that sense. Did you look at the review? Did you get a chance to look at?
Not your article, for okay. Not
because we have a different take altogether on this, because I don't believe that there is grace. Because once you, there has to be an embodiment, somebody to give grace.
Mm.
Okay? So if Brahman is the only reality, and Atman is Brahman, then I'm giving grace to myself? You see, it doesn't make sense.
Mm.
So in that sense, so that is why Mandukya Upanishad has this kind of a thing, because Mandukya was a very late Upanishad.
No, I fully agree with this quote, and here I didn't have the need to really resort to this, because this is a direct means of knowledge in some sort. This is part of a nivritti. I mentioned briefly the distinction between pravritti and nivritti. Pravritti being for those who have no discrimination, cannot carry out this kind of discriminative procedure. For those, of course, Shankara acknowledges that there is such thing as the grace of the Lord. And this is very important, because the grace of the Lord allows one to develop the mental equipment and physical equipment to then go on to nivritti practices of this order, which means the nivritti practices would be of the order of shravana, manana, and nididhyasana, hearing the scriptures from the mouth of the teacher, then reflecting on the meaning of these scriptures, and then meditating, the nididhyasana, meditating on the very self that has been, I think, distinguished from the not-self. That's how I take nididhya. And I will come to that, because then I also think that it's a type of devotion that one can really carry out in this nididhyasana. But I'll try to... I'm not sure. I can see the time. So. Okay. Huh? No, it's okay. Occasionally, so... One should keep in mind, of course, this basic, thank you, distinction. Is it ready? Okay. So one should keep in mind this distinction. What I've been trying to show you, demonstrate to you, is that this idea of creatorship is not something that one has to take on dogmatic ground. It is not like any, to my knowledge, any other religious tradition where the Lord is basically to be taken as an article of faith. Here, basically, it's a theology, a scripture-based theology that is brought to the level of direct experience of the student. And this is an important, I think, point. I think it's the strength, really, of the soteriology of Shankara, is that for the sadhaka, who really has the qualities of mind necessary, he can, for himself, by looking, by investigating at all the experiences that actually everyone experiences, regardless of, you know, status, race, denomination, or any other factors, everybody has these experiences, and one who has the quality of mind can look, reflect on these experiences, daily experiences, and come to intuit, even for a moment, the fact that one is the witnessing self of this state. These states come and they go to that witnessing self which one is to identify with. And one can see that one takes on the attribution, in a sense, the functions of the Lord by doing that. Now, from this, what can we do with devotion? Once you've taken that standpoint, let's say for a moment, you are that fact sheet. So, quickly through pravritti, if you haven't had that standpoint, then there is benevolence of the Lord. And we have, for example, in Bhagavad Gita 7.16, we have four types of devotees which are mentioned. Should I go through them? Do you all familiar with them? Quickly pass through them. Arjuna, men of good deeds, devoted to me, are of four kinds: the afflicted, the seeker after knowledge, the seeker after wealth, and the knower. Among them, the knower who is always united, entirely devoted, is superior. I am especially dear to the knower, and he is dear to me. Now, commenting on these verses, Shankara says that the devotion practiced by the first three types of devotees. And here, I have a question for you, because Shankara doesn't really differentiate between the seeker of knowledge and the other two devotees, the afflicted and the seeker after wealth. I'm not sure why there's no such distinction, because he put them all in the same bag, so to speak.
after her is one, these are inferior,
yeah,
in the sense that you are asking for something.
Yes.
But in a, you see, because in the moment of devotion, you are forgetting the ego. When you devote yourself to somebody else, you're completely surrendering to somebody else. In that moment of surrender, there is a forgetting of one's own individual ego, right?
But this is only the seeker.
I'm coming to each one. Okay? So, even in artha, why has he called him an artha? Because any kind of devotion will result in the purification of the mind.
Mm.
Because what is the first step? Is to purify.
Yes.
Because even before you come to Shravana, Manana, and Adhidhyasana, the first stage is Karma Yoga. You have to act in a detached manner so that your inner antakkarana becomes completely purified. So in that sense, bhakti or devotion is important. So that's why even artha, you see, one who is asking for something from an imaginary, let's say, Brahman, to cure one's son's illness.
Yeah.
Even in that moment, you are forgetting your own self. So to that extent, you have transcended the ego. So you have purified. That's why artha. Artho, jitnyasuhu is one who is desiring to know.
Yeah.
Jitnyasuhu. Arthati. Again, it is the third character. So, you know, the one who is asking for something.
Right.
So these three he clubs together. And then he says, jnani cha bharakusha. Jnani is one who is really the insightful.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your question?
Yeah, I was just wondering, with the knower I have no problem. I have a problem with these three. I feel like there's a distinction between someone who's devoted to the Lord because he wants something, he wants to have good crops, he wants to have a wife, whatever, and someone who's really desiring of moksha. He wants knowledge, this jnanasu. I feel like they're two very different kind of adhikari. They're not seeking one and the same goal. So they put them all in the same basket and selecting a part aside, the jnani. You would think there would be another progression, but there isn't.
Because for him it is only one who seeks to know Brahman.
Yeah.
Only he is at the top.
Yeah.
All the others, you may jitnyasu to know chemistry.
Yeah.
Or physics. Yeah, jitnyasu.
Perhaps that's what he means, not seeker of Brahman.
He
wants to know about biology or whatever.
Anything, all the knowledge.
I see. Never taken a glass measure. So therefore, yes. So these three sides, you fix it, the seeker of empirical knowledge.
One more thing. Remember, it's a very difficult text for Shankara to come in. See, Bhagavad Gita is an out-and-out dualistic text. So he finds it very difficult. And right in the introduction, he says, this is one text which I find very difficult to comment on. He himself.
He writes this.
Yes.
I'll give you that.
Then what happens is, maybe it was so important in the tradition.
Yeah.
Willy-nilly, he had to.
He had to, really.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Because I'm not at all happy. You look at it, it's very difficult for him. Particularly, only the second chapter he's comfortable with. All the others, it's a little difficult.
So the basic difference between these two cravings are what underpin the first three devotional activities of these devotees. With desires, grief and delusion as their root, these activities fall into the Parvati Dharma. The fourth type of devotion is characteristic of the aspirant who treads the path of Nivritti Dharma. Having adopted the Upanishadic perspective, the Sakshi Drishti we were talking about earlier, whereby he can contemplate himself as the Supreme Being, or the witness himself that is free from all actions, the knower seeks nothing other than being established in that knowledge. So, therefore, there are two essential devotional approaches to the Absolute, according to Shankara. The devotion to the featureless, non-manifest Absolute, and the devotion to the Absolute with features. These approaches go with two types of aspirants, those who have discernment and those who don't. While examining these two approaches, we can take Shankara's commentary on Bhagavad Gita 12 as our guiding text for his, where these two devotional approaches are clearly laid out. I will skip some of this because you've mentioned already part of this Parvati Dharma process. Commenting on Bhagavad Gita 12.5, Shankara says that devotion towards the non-manifest is much more difficult than devotion towards the manifest, on the basis that the former necessitates the absence of identification with the body. For Shankara, the next seven verses, 6 to 12, describe various devotional techniques of different orders, which ease the spiritual difficulties of the aspirant who continuously identifies with his body and senses. His gloss on these verses suggests that the sort of devotional means that involve a clear separation between the pupil and the Supreme Being, displaying multifarious attributes, are the result of the latter's compassion. Here again is the benevolence of the Lord towards aspirants with different spiritual capacities, all of them being unable to cease identifying with the body. Now this is clear in both the Bhagavad Gita and Shankara's use of language. In verses 8 to 11, for instance, four practices are enjoined successively. Each recommended practice is presented as being more accessible than the previous one. I think most of you are familiar with them, so I will not read them. So let's switch to the Nivritti. One of the significant byproducts from adopting the witnessing stance is that it shifts the function of creation, for example, generally attributed to a supreme deity, as found in all major religious traditions, to the immediate experience of the aspirant. Another significant development made possible for adopting this witnessing standpoint, born from the Upanishadic teachings, is a unique approach to devotion. Its uniqueness rests on the total identification with Ishvara. This is the form of devotion that Shankara deems superior, because it is based on the recognition of identity between the Lord and the devotee, as mentioned in Bhagavad Gita 7, the Vashya at least, 7.17. This recognition is indispensable to devotion in the Nivritti Dharma. The object of desires, sought after by all devotees other than the knower, the pupil with discrimination, are summed up into three: sons, wealth, and the heavenly world. In contradistinction to them, the knower establishes his devotion on the strength of his vision of the self, the witness of all. Such devotion is opposed to actions that are prompted by the three objects of desires. The knower renounces these three desires along with their means, all being of self. On the basis of Bhagavad Gita 7.17, we have seen that for Shankara, the exclusive devotion to the Supreme Being is possible for those who follow the path of Nivritti, which is solely concerned with knowledge and renunciation. However, is it not self-contradictory to state that the knower is involved in some activity, even that of contemplating the Supreme Being as himself? Is it not knowledge itself that eliminates the need to pursue all spiritual practices, whether based on knowledge or not? We shall attempt to answer these important questions by turning to key passages in the Bhagavad Gita Bhashya, notably in chapter 12 and 18, and by once again returning to Shankara's examination of the three states. Now let us first begin with an examination of Shankara's use of the compound Jnana Nishta in his Bhagavad Gita Bhashya 1860 and 55. And this is how Shankara interprets Nishta Jnanasya in 1860. The attainment of Brahman, which was promised to him, is expressed in the abiding of the knowledge, which is the highest. Nishta is the culmination, the final completion. The final completion of what? Of the knowledge of Brahman, which is the highest. What is it like? It is like the knowledge of the self. What is the self like? It is as Krishna defined it in Bhagavad Gita 18.17, the witness of the five factor of action, in accordance with the Upanishads and in accordance with reason. We see that in turn Shankara equates Nishta, the final completion of knowledge, with the actionless self without a second, the witness of the factors of action. To him, Nishta Jnanasya does not entail any effort to make knowledge more manifest, because knowledge is always fully manifest. In the case of Brahman, the establishment in knowledge simply involves the elimination of all name and form superimposed on the self through ignorance. Shankara makes this point very clear when pointing out the error committed by the materialists and the followers of the mind-only school of Buddhism, the Vijnanavadins, for whom the self can only be qualified by some adjuncts, the body and the mind respectively. So he writes, therefore, because it is fully established and manifest, no effort is involved in the apprehension of Brahman. What is to be done is merely to reject what is superimposed on Brahman through ignorance. In 1855, his explanation of Dhyana Nishtha is much more elaborate and informative concerning devotion. There, Shankara openly equates Dhyana Nishtha with the fourth and best type of bhakti, or devotion, which is based on the identity of the devotee and Ishvara, as already mentioned in Bhagavad Gita 7.17. The word Nishtha refers to the certainty about the apprehension of the self, which serves as the cause for the perfection of the knowledge of oneself that is free from contradiction. That condition, which consists in certainty of the knowledge of one's own self, along with the renunciation of all activities that rest on the perception of difference concerning the elements involved in action, like being an agent, that is the highest form of abiding in knowledge, which is based on the apprehension of the unity between the knower, the field, and the Supreme Self. The Jnana Nishtha was spoken in Bhagavad Gita 7.17 as the fourth type of devotion, other than the three devotions caused by distress. So this is important here because Jnana Nishtha is a conviction, he says, that is grounded on the immediate apprehension of oneself as the Supreme Being. Secondly, the important point is that he declares that Jnana Nishtha is effortless in that it only involves renouncing all the dualistic concepts that are involved in action, such as being an agent, a knower, a doer. And third, in the above quoted passage in Bhagavad Gita 1855, where Shankara refers back to Bhagavad Gita 7.17, Jnana Nishtha is deemed the highest form of devotion, which can only be practiced by the pupil who has discrimination, one who has directly apprehended Ishvara as himself. So therefore, the practice is nothing but to eliminate all that is not the self, and that practice itself is viewed as the highest kind of devotion. So the discipline is in fact a devotional practice in Shankara Vedanta. It's none other than that. Now, there are various practical aspects of the discipline. Many of them we find in, for example, Bhagavad Gita Bhashya 18:51-52 and Bhagavad Gita Bhashya 12:13-20 are basically all the disciplines which concern purification of the mind, of the senses, how one should eat, how one should sleep, very much also based on yoga, of course, Patanjali, with that respect, all kind of external and internal way to purify one's mind so as to be able to discriminate and perform the kind of devotional activities which are based on knowledge. So essentially they emphasize, yes, control of the senses, control of the mind and the intellect, so as to help the continuous devotion to the Lord, which is one's own very self, one's awareness, immediately revealed. Now there is, among all these practices, there is one, which is a spiritual discipline of the renunciate devotee, which is called Nididhyasana. And this is the last point I will make here. Now, the sole spiritual practices that can still be of significance for the man who has discrimination are those that contribute to the elimination of the impediments to liberation, a liberation that is ever acquired. One of the disciplines that a discerning pupil can cultivate is prescribed by the Upanishad under the name Nididhyasana. It is this same discipline that Shankara refers to in Bhagavad Gita Bhashya 18.52 under the term Dhyana Yoga, and which also the Bhagavad Gita chapter 6 proceeds to unfold. This is exactly the same one. Dhyana Yoga Bhagavad Gita, in my opinion. Dhyana Yoga 1852 are one and the same discipline, Nididhyasana or Dhyana Yoga. Now, Shankara clearly says that for the highly qualified pupil, merely the listening of scriptures, Shravana, if the student is qualified and the teacher has the qualities also, which means he's a Brahmanishtha, established in Brahman, and a Shrotriya, who also knows about all the scriptures, that's the qualities of the teacher. If both are apt students and teachers, then Shravana alone, hearing the scriptures, is enough to enlighten the pupil. But he says for those, when that doesn't happen and the student doesn't have the quality of mind necessary, there are, he says that the repeat practice of Shravana, Manana and Nididhyasana should be resorted to in order for the student to be drawn to enlightenment. Nididhyasana is in fact for those who need to seek their knowledge in a decisive way. Prajna Pratishthita. For these are still open to the dangers of attachment to and desires for sense objects. Nididhyasana is not followed for the purpose of acquiring a new knowledge of the self, since it bears to repeat it again. Shankara believes that the self, which the Upanishads point to, is immediately evident and directly known. It involves controlling both the senses and the mind and directing the latter towards and ultimately merging it into the self. So basically what it is you can conceive this practice as, you know, the mind is like western doors on hinges, and this practice needed design is just to bring the doors within, that's all. And by doing that, one should continuously focus on the self alone by discarding all the rest, niti niti atma. There are many places where this practice is actually mentioned. I'll quote just a couple of them. Bhagavad Gita 13:24, withdrawing the hearing organs, etc., into the mind from their respective objects like sound, and in turn causing the mind to turn towards the inner self, that is dhyanam. And Bhagavad Gita Bhasha 18:55, abiding in knowledge is the means for the continuous contemplation on the notion of the inner self and its devotion. The best image is the tortoise, again, withdrawing its limbs like this. So all these mouths we mentioned about, the idea is that the mouth has to be basically turned inward. They naturally, the Lord says, you know, in creation that the senses were, outwardly. Now the whole point of Nidhyasana is to turn these apertures, in fact close them up, and bring the mind within, so as to contemplate this self-effulgent consciousness which is always present in the nature of each and every one of us. Now the interesting point here is that we're still talking about the one who has discrimination, and the Bhagavad Gita acknowledges that even for one who has discrimination, the senses can still carry him or her outwardly. And in Bhagavad Gita, Bhasha 2:6 is what it says, the tumultuous senses lead him, the learned, towards sense objects, and confounding him, they carry him off forcibly, although the mind is endowed with discriminatory knowledge. So even it is just the practice of the renunciate devotee who does that. His senses are still going outwardly, and he still has to adopt this kind of lifestyle. So, gradually withdrawing into oneself by successively merging one source of erroneous identification into a subtler one, commencing from the sense organs and ending with the I notion, to the point where the pupil can apprehend the self as I am the witness of this I notion, is basically the process of Nididhyasana in Shankara's writing. And that is the highest sense of devotion we can find, I think, in Shankara's Vedanta. So, what makes Nididhyasana a very special upasana? It's not that he turns devotion to an act of meditation in a certain sense. It's not, and this is worth pointing out, that again, it's not like the Patanjali Yoga where something new is to be, what new experience is to be achieved or acquired. There's nothing such as that. One simply, again, eliminates what is not. No new experience. Shankara would criticize the Yoga because, you see, the experience that is to be gotten in the Nirvikalpa Samadhi, or Samkarnyata Samadhi, is that you begin this experience at some point in time. And for Shankara, if non-duality comes in time, it necessarily has to end in time. And therefore, this cannot really be liberation, because liberation is eternal. He says in many places in Brahma Sutra Bhashya that our nature of being is moksha. This is who we are. We're always eternally liberated, nitya mukta, and therefore it can be really the means, because anything that begins in time ends in time, and it can be what provides liberation. So Nididhyasana cannot be equated with samadhi as it has been, I think many, many authors, I think, have made that mistake. Even recent ones, Deutsch also thinks that way, and I think it's erroneous. But I think that's why it's important to show that Yatana is nothing but a devotional means that is resorted by the person who has discrimination.
I'm discussing that, this Thursday.
Ah, very good. And but there is more. I don't want to go on, because already 5 after 3, but I think I've given you most of the gist of what I wanted to. So perhaps no, because this is before.
Yeah.
I have another patient.
Well,
I have enough.
Right? Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I want to differentiate, because here we spoke about the knower who has discrimination. Now, one can think that by discriminating like this, when the state one becomes, you know, Brahman, and that's it. It's a bit heretic. One can say, you know, you think that the state is through God. Everybody, just by analyzing its states, can be God and apprehend God like that. In some sense, yes. In some sense, no. And we must further try to explain why it is so. When said decisively, our question about the possibility for the knower to pursue any devotional practice, including that which is based on knowledge, like Nididhyasana, it is necessary to distinguish between two kinds of knowers. First, by the term knower, Shankara refers to the student who has discernment, the Vivekī, but who has not been decisively liberated through the teachings of the Upanishads due to such impediments as attachment to sense objects. This is the type of student with whom we have been concerned here. The devotional discipline in which such a student engages himself consists in withdrawing to himself, as it were, and this does not exclude the use of techniques meant to prevent the mind and the senses from engaging with worldly objects because of the natural propensity to seek out objects. However, it is when this knower identifies with Ishvara, when he takes on his attributes, that the highest form of devotion is achieved, although there, the ordinary usage of the word devotion does not apply on account of the student's immediate and direct coalescing with Ishvara. It remains that both the Bhagavad Gita and Shankara's use of these terms, even in the context of the apparent identification with Ishvara, if so, as Bhagavad Gita Parsha 7:17 shows. But the student's identification with Ishvara stops short of liberation. For the final means of knowledge, the Antya Pramana is only the teaching that eradicates all attributions, including that of being the Supreme Deity, the single witness in all beings, the witness that objectifies the field, the state, that everything like that. The Antya Pramana is that which puts an end to the distinction of knower, means of knowing, and the known. You see, when you take that stand of the witness, you are, of course, you no longer identify with a waking individual in a waking state, but now you have taken up other adjuncts. Now you are witness. Yes, you witness, and you have all the sovereign qualities of Ishvara, but you still are a witness of something. You're a witness of the state. There is still very much a dualistic conception. But this isn't what liberation is about. Brihad Ranikal says, when one has become the Ratman, what shall he see and through what? What shall he know and through what? He has no means of knowing anything, and there's nothing else than himself to be known in the first place. So it can be the knower, he who has decisively put an end to his ignorance. This pramana negates the notion of being a knower of prakriti, a witness of the field, which the scriptures themselves establish as a teaching aid to turn the aspirant away from this natural identification with the body, mind, and senses. As long as the final pramana remains unfulfilled, that is to say, until the moment when all forms of false identification have ceased, the possibility of devotion for the aspirant who follows the path of pravity and nivriti is factual. The other knower that Shankara refers to is thus the knower described by Yajnavalkya in the Brihadaranyaka 4.5.15. One who has become the self, Yajnavalkya says, can no longer apprehend anything, for objects of knowledge and the corresponding means are absent. This is the knower who has been freed from this condition of being a witnessing self, an all-knowing and all-pervading self, the last stumbling block that stands before liberation. For this knower, nothing at all can be witnessed, within or without. Does this amount to an admission that two objects of knowledge correspond to these two types of knowers, and that the nivriti discipline that the renunciant devotee follows is, like the pravati discipline, based on ignorance? Chakra certainly tells us so from the very start in his Brahma Sutra Bhashya. All worldly and Vedic actions involving means of knowledge and objects of knowledge, as well as all scriptures, whether concerned with injunctions, prohibitions, or liberation, they all proceed by following this mutual superimposition of the self and the not-self called ignorance. Another part of the Adhyasa Bhashya. These sentences in the thousands show the dual forms of Brahman in accordance with the different conditions of knowledge and ignorance. It is in the state of ignorance that Brahman is involved in empirical dealings, comprising objects of meditation, someone who meditates, and so on. The finality of the Vedantic teaching is the elimination of all sense of duality, and it is not what the pupil arrives at by adopting the standpoint of Ishvara or the witnessing self. For Shankara, moksha demands the realization of the one reality without a second in qualified Brahman. However, this does not entail that Ishvara or the witnessing self and the unqualified Brahman are two separate objects of knowledge. Shankara considers Ishvara or the witness and the unqualified Brahman to be one and the same reality, since scriptures describe both the higher and the lower as the cause of creation. And this again is no dilemma for Shankara, who explains that the distinction between the two is apparent, since the qualifying features of Brahman are an effect of ignorance. Even the subtle attributions made on Brahman, such as being eternally cognizant, Shankara says, are only figurative. The cognizing act of the witness, for example, is used figuratively for the absolute that is but unqualified cognition. In Bhagavad Gita 13.2, he says, the opponent says, there is this defect that the knower of the field cognizes a faulty field. The advisor answers is, no, because of the figurative use of being a cognizing entity for the immutable entity whose nature is but cognition. It is like the figurative heating activity of the fire that is in fact nothing but heat. Hence it is also proper to speak of devotion in Shankara Vedanta in a figurative way. For when this last imputation of lordship is eliminated by the Antyapramana of the Upanishads, undifferentiated consciousness alone is realized as the only reality of the past, present, and future. So I think I'll stop here and just stressing the important point again that all this idea of imputations basically have to be resorted by the Upanishads and the teacher out of compassion for the ignorant pupil who doesn't know that he is the ever free, ever liberated pure awareness that is common. He's ignorant of that, and therefore the scriptures, you know, they condescend to that student and attribute all these qualities, such as the witnessing self who is ever cognizant, and lead one to identify with that, to in turn negate even that subtle attribution, so that one can realize one's non-dual reality. So there is a pedagogical aspect that is not to be missed here, and one is not to stop again at this idea that yes, the Viveki, the Jnani is really the one liberated here. He has discrimination, so we need to differentiate between the knower of the Anuvalkya, he who cannot apprehend anything because there is nothing but pure consciousness alone, there is nothing to be witnessed by this individual, and there is the one who is a Viveki, who takes himself to be a witness. And the state that appear, he falsifies the state. They appear to him, but he's the witness, never affected by them. But they continue appear and disappearing to him. But he has the discrimination is the strength that I think is part, that is integral to the soteriology of Shankara. So I know it was a lot really to cover, and I didn't even really get into, you know, kind of grace so much, but I hope that was a bit helpful. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them. Yes?
Maybe you did mention that you had some comment while you were talking about Christ, that I thought kind of you said something that I kind of drifted off.
Yes.
And by the time I got back to you, I don't know, maybe you did mention, but what exactly was
Markovsky's argument is that, and it's a great work in general, but he makes one argument, which is a decisive one, which is that ultimately, the student of Advaita, even in the Nivriti, which means that the Shravana Manana Nididhyasana is left in a state of expectancy where the last resort is the Lord. The last liberating ultimate factor is the Lord. Because all that the scriptures do, again, is to give you an intellectual knowledge. So you're left with the expectancy of some saving power. And his argument is that Shankara actually advocates that, ultimately. I think he makes many mistakes concerning, for example, he thinks that Shravanamanana and Nididhyasana are non-mediate means of knowledge. In fact, they are mediatory means of knowledge. In fact, they are non-mediate means of knowledge. They are direct means of knowledge. But he doesn't seem to really see that. And I think that's where... And also, I think he has an important Vaishnava influence in his background, and I think he resorts to that a lot, and he reads a lot in Shankara, because it's true that Shankara's Bhasha is filled with Vaishnava terminology and even devotional practices, objects of practices. So I think he makes this easy leap, and this first misconception and this influence of Vaishnava tradition, I think, leads him to make this assertion.
He also uses words. I think he depends too much on three or four words in the whole of the Brahma Sutra, Anukampa, things like that. Which in answer can mean. But Shankara doesn't really mean devotion when he uses those words.
Yeah.
And Mankowski comes from a Christian theological background. And he wants to read Shankara as if, there is devotion. Because for a Christian theologian, including Francis Rumi, the ultimate means for moksha is devotion. So you see, they try to read that into it. So you're coming with a presumption, and that's the type. Yeah, I have written a long review about that in the American Orient as well, and I was watching it.
Did I have the journal, the Hindu Christian Bulletin?
Yes.
It's not there. It was none of them are there. I was asked to look at the Library of Congress to find them.
They
don't subscribe to that. No.
In the body,
not even
in the institute.
Yes, I was able to get the site, but I don't know, there's nothing to download or. And I think he mistakes also this samsiddhi. I think he reads samsiddhi as the perfection, whereas it's the perfection of the mind. He reads it as the ultimate perfection.
It's a good book, but starting off with the premise already.
Yeah.
If you start with a hypothesis and then look for that, it doesn't seem to be an open minded approach. Depends too much on Bhagavad Gita. That's because I'll only add one more, and then Shankara's mainly, when you go to Shankara to find out anything about Shankara, we depend mainly on three things. One is his own Brahma Sutra Bhashya, then his Upanishad Bhashya, and then of course his Upadesha Bhashya.
Yeah.
Not so much on the Bhagavad Gita, because Bhagavad Gita is openly a Vaishnava text. And very much connected, it's in the tradition of Vishishtadvaita and Madhvas Vaita. So it is very difficult for Shankara to really comment in an Advaitic manner on Bhagavad Gita. And yet he does it. The second chapter, as I said, is not easy. But anyway, so the Upadesha Bhashya doesn't have even a single reference to devotion.
Yeah. Only in the Sabriti Dharma it's very important
obviously you're not reading devotion into the text, as some other scholars might, but how it seems that you're defining devotion in a very interesting, unorthodox way. How would you, can you say it in sentence, how you define devotion?
So I think devotion in its apogee, devotion, I've argued that is present in two, the Pravriti Dharma and the Nirvriti Dharma. Pravriti Dharma is very much the same as the Vaishnava tradition, we have no problem with that. It's only, but it's for the purpose of purifying the mind of the student, so he can come to the Upanishad with it. Once the mind is pure, he can approach the Upanishad, he can actually begin the Upanishadic, the Vedantic studies proper. Okay. Now, in the Nivritti Dharma, devotion is understood is within the Jnana Nishtha. It's within one who desires the ripening of knowledge. This is the Paripakka aspect of knowledge. And to do that, Nididhyasana is really, Jnana Nishtha and Nididhyasana are the two elements where devotion takes place, basically. Which is just to take the senses and the mind and bring them within to contemplate the self-evident witness, which is always present.
So you understand that the staff act, the shrine of this is an act of devotion.
Yeah, that's how actually, you know, quote, Shankar calls it. This is, and he said, he equates that with the highest devotee of the Bhagavad Gita 7.17. That knower, you know, the four knowers, that last one, that knower, he's the one who can have devotion in the Nivritti Dharma. Yes, there was a lot in the Bhagavad Gita, because there was one of the points, because, you see, I think the overwhelming majority of scholars say that, because Shankara emphasized so much knowledge, they think, they brush it aside. They, you know, usually, actually, conveniently, they say, Shankara conveniently arranges all the material that's theistic in nature in the category of Vyavahara. That's it. He brushes it aside. He doesn't brush it aside at all, in my opinion. And I hope I was trying to show that even by using what is considered the most theistic text, one can see that it's not the case. And actually, it's very much up to the higher, most profound discipline, which is that discipline, I think, of discrimination. Devotion is there. It's very much present.
But a different meaning is
a different meaning, of course, because then the identification with not something external, of course, not an image or a concept, but with one's very self, as the creator, as an originator, as, you know, having a sovereign Brahman, really. This is what one identifies with and is devoted to.
Yeah.
So he takes on a whole different meaning, of course. Yeah, this is, I mean, this is difficult to... this in itself, this Avastatraya Viveka, is such a difficult and profound teaching that I probably didn't do justice to, and it would take a whole, you know, 2 hours to try to do that, if I was even able to. But I think, I hope I was able to give you a glimpse of the method at work there, and also not the fact, again, that it's something that truly exists, and that there is a fourth state to be attained. You know, there is no such thing as a fourth state transcending those. And that's why I wrote here the self, it's the one and the same self with the adjuncts. And these adjuncts, again, have no existence of their own. They're imaginary. And they're taken as true. Just like the student takes it as true, so also the Upanishads and the teacher take them as true. And take this as a basis of teaching. It's not really that there is a fourth one to be attained, a transcendental state that's not present in the we are Brahman all throughout. You know, it's not to be attained in some fourth state. So I think it's an important point that needs to be stressed.